Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Reports of the demise of Western democracy may be greatly exaggerated. Theresa May lost her conservative parliamentary majority in a shocking election result last week in the UK, less than a year after Brexit. Marine Le Pen took that drubbing in France. Donald Trump's job approval is in the 30s. And yet, it feels like we're on the precipice of losing the heart of the Enlightenment values of the last 500 years. In a new book, The Retreat of Western Liberalism, Financial Times columnist Edward Luce argues Trumpism is not the cause, but a deeply alarming symptom. Edward Luce worked as a speechwriter for the Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration and is now based in Washington as the Financial Times Washington columnist and commentator. Again, his book is The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Edward Luce, welcome back to WNYC.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What do you mean, first of all, by Western liberalism?
So I don't mean majority voting. I mean all the stuff that preceded it, what the founding fathers and great Victorian liberals like John Stuart Mill championed, which is independent judicial system, which is a strong civil society, which is a check on majority rule, the tyranny of the majority.
Can I jump in? Because I think that's so important. And this comes up from time to time on the show. Fareed Zakaria is very good on this and some others, that when we talk about democracy, the first thing that comes out of people's mouth is, oh, democracy is majority rule. Well, yeah, democracy is majority rule, but democracy is also the checks on majority rule, so there isn't a tyranny of the majority.
Absolutely right. And, you know, if you look at one area that's more troubling, that Hungary, Viktor Orban, the hard right Putinist president of Hungary, leader of Hungary, calls himself, now boasts that Hungary is an illiberal democracy. And why does he call it that? He's absolutely right to define it as that, because he's changed the constitution to suit his party. The courts are basically cowed into approving whatever he does. And he and people related to him and connected to his party basically control the media now. So the liberal portion is being closed down. Democracy then follows. That's the real concern.
And he boasts that his country, his government, is an illiberal democracy?
He boasts about it because his great hero is Putin. And he's borrowed very explicitly all kinds of Putinism, which is very troubling, because just a few years ago, all these former Soviet satellites craved to join the European Union. And now they're sort of openly dissing the rules of the club they so desperately wanted to join. Poland, of course, Poland is another liberal democracy that is becoming an increasingly illiberal democracy.
In any way that you could state in brief?
Yes, the Justice and Law Party that runs the country are changing the constitution, bringing in sort of respect and for religious, for the Catholic Church, sort of chilling free speech. And again, thumbing their nose at Brussels and at broader European, Western, liberal, democratic values. And that's a big, it's a real concern.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. I'm Brian Lehrer with the Financial Times Washington columnist and commentator Edward Luce, whose new book is The Retreat of Western Liberalism. And we can take your phone calls for him on these big ideas at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Funny enough, one of the Russia connections here is that the Steve Bannons of the world see Putin as the prime defender of what they consider Western Judeo-Christian values, including conservative Christian ones. Are you aware of that movement in that light?
Indeed. And, Putin's record with Russia's Muslims, remember, about a fifth of Russia is Muslim, places like Chechnya. And Putin's record is some brutal record with Muslim minorities in Russia is something they very much admire. But there is another sort of Bannon-Putin connection here, and that's that Putin really pioneered the use of what they call political technology in Russia, the use of psychological warfare methods and of reality TV to manipulate public opinion. And long before, you know, we came up with the phrase fake news and post-truth and phrases like that, Putin was really, you know, pioneering these kinds of methods of manipulating public opinion.
It's also got an anti-gay, anti-woman, LGBTQ, you know, gender identity issues cast to it, doesn't it? Putin is a hero to people in that camp because he stands for some kind of old-fashioned masculinity and gender identity.
Yep, and the bare-chested Putin sort of hunting bears is one of the favorite images he projects. He's tied himself to Mother Russia, the whole idea of the Orthodox Church as being the soul of Russia. Again, something Steve Bannon, I think, approves of. That, of course, entails a fair amount of misogyny, homophobia, and all kinds of sort of what you'd call anti-urban values. And it's very interesting to note that even though the election wasn't a level playing field, the last time he was elected president of Russia, 2012, more than half of Moscow voted against him. More than half of Moscow, the young, those who are sort of exposed to the world, they don't like him. And they're protesting right now all across Russia.
So it's just like here, in a certain respect, the urban-rural divide. And there are these two sort of competing views of what the West is and what there is about traditional Westernism to protect.
Indeed. This idea that we are essentially a large civilization, we're the West, and there is this mortal threat from transcendent sort of threat from Islam and from the Middle East is, I think, a very, very different and very dark idea of what it is the West means. Because, you know, Enlightenment values is what we're talking about, came out of the long, dark Christian medieval night. It's those values, really, that I think that I'm sounding the alarm on.
And one way we got to this point of alarm, you're right, is that both the UK and the US fell hard for their own false propaganda, pushing the dream of meritocracy when it doesn't actually exist. How does the false belief in meritocracy lead to populism, and how false do you think it was?
Well, so don't get me wrong. I think meritocracy is a very good thing. Here in America, we, and in my sort of country of birth, Britain, have taken to breastfeeding and boasting more loudly than other democracies about how we really are perfect lands of equality of opportunity and meritocracy. And if you look at the numbers, it's really very different. It is much harder to move from a lower income bracket to a higher one if you live in the United States or in Britain than in almost any other Western democracy. In Canada, it's you're twice as likely. And Germany, you're twice as likely to move up an income group and indeed to fall down an income group. Mm-hmm. There is more mobility, mm-hmm. in other words, in other Western democracies, including France, which is, you know, we have this idea it's a sclerotic, stagnating place. But if you look at it at the individual level, you're born poor in France, you have a way bigger chance of fulfilling the American dream than if you're born poor nowadays in the United States.
Why, most fundamentally?
You know, I think the elites have done brilliantly in America and in Britain at reproducing themselves. There's one phrase I think that stands very well for what we're talking about, the hereditary meritocracy. All the stuff, very naturally, we do for our kids because we want the best for them. We get them weekend tutors. We structure their weekends. We read to them every night. We, they take music lessons. lessons. They go to really good summer camps. All that, those kinds of things build up the kind of social capital that enables you to thrive in society. And it's understandable we do it, but if you add it up collectively, it's what a colleague of mine, Richard Reeves, who's at the Brookings Institution, calls opportunity hoarding. And we're better at doing that in the English-speaking democracies, I think, than in other democracies.
And yet, to that point, or related to that point, you write that another delusion is that the U.S. and Britain suffer from an illusion about the value of qualifications. They routinely confuse having a college degree with being skilled, and that lacking a college degree makes you a loser.
Yes. And I think, you know, this is an area where a country like Germany and maybe much of Scandinavia has got it more right than we have, because there are vocational systems for training people in very, very skilled and respected occupations that doesn't involve getting a college degree. I know plenty of people, including sometimes myself, who have college degrees and postgraduate degrees who have no real skills. Whereas there are technicians in the German labor market who get paid well, haven't been to college, they get paid well, but more importantly, and I think this is really, really crucial, they have self-respect and dignity in their labor. And we tend to view people without college degrees as losers. So they get angry. They vote Trump. They vote Brexit.
So do you think Trump, regardless of anything else he's doing, is on the right track with the apprenticeship programs that he's announced a couple of times in the last few weeks?
Yeah, I mean, he's got a habit of announcing all kinds of stuff that, you know, never sees the light of day. So sure, it's better he's talking about it than he isn't. It's better that he's occasionally talking about a big infrastructure program than he isn't. But I'm really skeptical that he's got the sort of patience and attention, focus, and skill, political skill, to push anything through. But it's the right topic.
Is there an actual plan attached to that topic?
No, there's no more of a plan than the one-page tax reform plan that they came out with last month. Not thought through, not detailed.
Samita in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Edward Luce from the Financial Times, author of The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Hello, Samita.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. And just one request. I'd called once before, but before I could ask a follow-up or a rejoinder, I was cut off. So just that request, just in case.
We'll keep you on for a follow-up question.
Okay,
go ahead.
Thank you very much. So my question for your guest today is that I'm a historian of the British Empire, and I've worked on the Enlightenment and empires. My question is, could you just talk a little bit about the fact that the Enlightenment comes out of Europe, you know, at the same time that the rest of the world is being colonized? There's a contradiction there, and there are inconsistencies. And the question is not just to address that on its own, but perhaps some of the contradictions and the mess that we see around us right now, how much of that is related to the fact that there were some issues that were never ever clarified, and the West was happy to live with that contradiction? Of course, then it was defined and justified in terms of race, yeah, or in terms of the fact that some people needed to be left in this condition of inequality and subjugation, et cetera.
Yes. Let me get a response, and partly so we have time for a follow-up.
Okay.
Yes.
And you put a lot on the table.
Okay,
go ahead.
Good, rich question. I was actually based in India for the Financial Times for 5 years, and I'm fascinated by your country. Look, the Indian independence movement, led by Mohandas Gandhi, but also by Jawaharlal Nehru, these were brilliant, brilliant leaders of the anti-colonial movement in India, because they asked for the same rights for Indians that the British accorded themselves back home. A brilliant strategy, which worked. And India now has one of the great products of the Enlightenment in Indian form, which is a secular democracy that has lasted for 70 years and is in rude health. So I think what India did was it called out the colonial hypocrisy and said, if you mean this enlightenment, then everybody should be under the same sun. And it worked. So you're quite right to point out double standards from the colonial era. And, you know, we're always right to point out the double standards of the slave-owning founding fathers. But if it's when you hold them to those standards that progress is made.
And make your follow-up brief, please.
Okay, I'll make it very brief. So my question was not about colonialism itself. It was about the values, the Western values that you're talking about. And I'm saying that in their implementations, I mean, India has other problems. Its democracy is not working perfectly. So, but my question is going to the heart of the definition of these values. It was the implementation of these values that raised questions, which I feel we should address if we want to understand what's happening today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Samita.
Fair enough. I mean, look, the perfect should not be the enemy of the good. These are good values to aspire to. The fact that none of us, I mean, not just India, but in the West, perfectly adhere to them shouldn't blind us to their universal application.
Regina in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Edward Luce. Hi, Regina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is piggybacking on the French election plus the use of the word liberal in your title. And I was listening to CNN on the day of the election, and Christian Amanpour described Macron as a neoliberal. And the announcer at CNN just kept referring to him as a liberal. And I know that there are profound differences between the two. And so my question to you is how did neoliberalism, which is just so dominating our public discourse, I mean, we had a conversation a while ago with the mayor where someone from Brooklyn called in to say the bus service is just disappearing. And we see this in Manhattan, too. And he said, well, you know, if there's enough need for it, we will have it. Well, no. Under Mayor Bloomberg, there was a whole lessons that we have to make do more with less mantra that to me is really
That's neoliberalism. Right. So in a way, Bill Clinton was a neoliberal in a way that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders are liberals. Fair?
Yes, I think that's fair. I'd go so far with Corbyn to say he's a socialist, in fact. But, you know, Macron is both. He's a neoliberal in the sense he's going to undertake some Thatcher Reagan like labor market reforms. The French love their short working week. He doesn't. He's going to shrink the state. So in that respect, Macron's a neoliberal, but he's also socially very progressive, pro-gay marriage, young and modern looking in his social values. So in that sense, he's also a liberal. And I guess, you know, you could say the same for Bill Clinton.
And I think an interesting follow-up on that question is going to come from Fred in Edison. Hi, Fred, you're on WNYC.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Question and on the title of your book. Title of the book, if I remember correctly, is The Retreat of Liberalism.
Western Liberalism, yes.
Well, okay. I'm not too sure how you mean it. Are you talking about... Let me finish the question before you, because it's a two-part question.
They're like reporters out there today. They want follow-ups. They want two-part questions.
I'm with them.
Kidding, I'm Fred. Fred. Go ahead.
No, forgive me. I don't mean it that way. No, the issue is it retreating to progressivism, or is it retreating because, like in the last number of years, the Democrats have lost about 10,000 seats throughout the country, going from local, state, and federal positions. And so what is the retreat that you're talking about?
It's a very good question. I'm talking about, as Brian sort of teased out of me, about liberalism in the non-American tribal sense here. So about the Enlightenment values, the systems of political democracy that we have across the West. And I feel that they are under challenge because primarily the middle class across the West is being squeezed. And if you have no strong middle, then politics tends to polarize too. In America, we've seen that happening on steroids.
And so for people to understand where you come from, historically, you were a speechwriter for Lawrence Summers when he was Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, right?
Indeed.
So that's the neoliberal establishment of that day. And you write in the book that Obama-type liberalism is partly to blame for the retreat of the West. You point to President Obama's over-reliance on the phrase, "That is not who we are." And related, you take Hillary Clinton's campaign to task for reflectively bowing to both identity politics and political correctness.
Indeed. Look, when Obama and Hillary talked about people being on the wrong side of history, say on marriage equality, I'm a strong supporter of marriage equality, by the way. It was extremely bad politics, partly because they themselves were on the wrong side of history a few years before. Hillary Clinton only came to support of marriage equality in 2013, Obama in 2012, I believe. So that is bad tactics. If you're on the wrong side of history, you're being told you're on the wrong side of history, you're not going to feel very good about yourself. You're going to lash out. You're going to vote for whoever else is running against you. And I think a lot of that happened. As regards identity politics, Hillary Clinton did what I think was a sort of ethnic sort of building block operation, which is anti-racist, but is a sort of mirror image of racism. It helps legitimize those on the right who are sort of been pursuing white nationalist dog whistles for many, many years. Trump, of course, exchanged the dog whistle for a megaphone. But the West's demographic triumph, a demographic triumphalism, in a funny way validated its opposite, which is, we're talking about race. Why are we talking about race? We should be talking about economic opportunity for people of all races.
But this, and then we're going to be out of time, you know, is going to drive so many people listening right now crazy because they're going to say anti-racism is not the moral equivalent of racist dog whistles. And so much has to do, so much of disadvantage and inequality and, you know, the practical things that affect people's lives have to do with identity-based oppression of one kind or another. And so it hasn't worked when they didn't acknowledge it. So to acknowledge it is the only right thing to do.
You should acknowledge it. I certainly wouldn't for a second believe there's any moral equivalence. I'm talking here about tactical results, is how you win elections. And I think if, writing off large chunks of your society is deplorable, is really bad way of getting people to the polls, or at least of getting them to the polls to vote for you. And so it's really the tactics. But the crisis we're in affects people of all races. I think a more common middle class appeal is a far better form of politics. It's also a better form of policy.
Edward Luce is Washington columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. His new book is The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Thank you so much for coming in.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Brian.